I've been waiting for this one, y'all.
I'm gonna show you what's up right now.
So I'm 23, 24 with a 5-bedroom, 2-car garage, brand new house, and a brand new subdivision. And so that was like the first two deals.
Are you ready?
Boom!
Wait a minute.
Leg out.
Welcome to the Todd Capital Millionaire Podcast.
Holla at your boy.
At Todd Capital, we believe business and investing are team sports. And this podcast is for those who want to turn their capital into generational legacy.
It's what y'all been waiting for, ain't it?
Yo, it's the Options Trading Workshop, presented by Todd Capital. Learn the fundamentals and advanced trading strategies that allow us the chance to earn $20,000 in side money in 1 year while working a job and running multiple businesses. That's right. Learn the what, the where, and the how of options trading in this exclusive webinar. To find out more details, hit us up on the link in the bio, on Instagram at Partner with Millie, or on Instagram at Todd.Capital, or just head over to Gumroad.com/Todd Capital.
This episode is brought to you by 24/7 Watches. Shop our limited edition luxury watches at 247watches.com. That's TWENTY47watches.com. Use code Todd Capital at checkout for a special discount. And don't forget to follow us on Instagram at 247 Watches. That's at TWENTY47 Watches.
Hey everybody, it's your girl Erica Williams from the Classy Climb blog. I'm a six-figure YouTube earner and the author of the book Smartphone Millionaire, How to Lend to People, Real Estate, and Businesses from the Palm of Your Hand. And if you're interested in the three things that changed my life over the past 4 years to become a six-figure YouTube earner and investor in multiple properties in multiple states, I would love for you to join me over at the Classy Climb YouTube channel.
And here are your hosts, Miss Flipping in Heels, Roshana Scott, and Mr. Todd Millionaire himself, Charles Oglesby.
So this is the Todd Capital Millionaire Podcast. It's episode 145. My name is Charles Oglesby, also known as Todd Millionaire, founder and director of the Todd Capital Investment Club, here with Miss Roshana Scott out of Chicago. How you doing, Miss Roshana?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm blessed. I'm better than I deserve is what Dave Ramsey says. So feeling good.
Staying safe, COVID-free.
Yeah, I got like multiple masks, walk around with two masks layered up. No, I'm just kidding.
You wasn't at the store buying a pot of hand sanitizer, was you? Was that you?
Nope. I don't even really believe in the coronavirus stuff. But we saw a 5-star rating. We like ratings. Thank you guys all for tuning in. The purpose of this podcast is to share the stories of successful African-American business owners and investors, so that people can hear the stories of successful examples. They exist. With us today, we have Mrs. Fabiola Florenville. She goes by Invest with Fab on Instagram. She's been doing some great things in Detroit, and I didn't even realize that she was a long-distance real estate investor. So that is cool. We can definitely talk about that. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me. Thanks for having me, Roshana and Charles.
So can you tell us a little bit about who you are and where you're from?
Okay, well, I'm a Miami girl. I'm born and raised in Miami, but I spent some years in Atlanta. I went to grad school in Atlanta. So I started investing actually in Atlanta, and then I moved back to Miami after the real estate crash, and I've been there ever since. So Atlanta is like home number two, but I live in between two worlds. So I have a marketing agency that I've been running since 2006. So I essentially work within the government sector and also the corporate worlds. And then I have my real estate life that pretty much run parallel to each other. So
that's cool.
Sometimes that's interesting, but it's like two different parts of my brain sometimes working at the same time.
So the question that we typically lead off with is, what was life like growing up?
Huh, interesting. Okay, so I come from immigrant parents. So I'm the first generation, first born in America. So for me, it was always like, you know, you're gonna make it happen. All of y'all gonna make it happen being here. But my life was pretty good growing up. So I had a pretty good childhood and pretty good education that I think was a good foundation for me. And then obviously going through that and then college, I went to Florida A&M and then Clark Atlanta University. So those were like really good solid beginnings for me. But I've always been an entrepreneur. So I remember vividly like in the 7th grade, I had already told my family that I was not gonna go to work. So I figured out how to make money at that young age. I was selling chips and candy. And because I was gifted, I skipped through the 12th grade. So I was always hustling between 7th and 11th grade. So by the time 12th grade came around, I was like, all right, I'm off to college. So I was always very aggressive, very ambitious, always like looking at what's next. That got me into a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. But still, it was always like for a bigger purpose.
I want to talk about your marketing agency. So you started that, you said, around the last crash or pre-crash. And was that something like, did you go to school for marketing? Or was it like right out of college? You know, how did you get into that? And then also, you know, I want to touch on something that you said that's key as far as having government and corporate clients.
Yeah, so I actually started marketing and real estate at the same time. So I was in grad school, you know, typical route, they want you to go into corporate America, especially going to an HBCU because you're representing essentially for HBCUs to go into corporate America. But I always knew that that was just not going to be my fit. So graduated and I'm like, you know, I had already gone through interviews and I was like, I don't want to do any of these jobs. So it was like, what you going to do next? You know, I was like, well, I'm going to have to make my own job up. And that's literally what I did. You know, I was like, I took an internship for 6 months. Coming out of grad school, you look crazy. You know, everyone's looking for those six-figure, you know, salaries and sign-in bonuses. And you over here talking about you're going to take a free internship. But that's essentially what I did for 6 months coming out of grad school. And once I felt secure and confident enough in terms of like the business side of things and like how to go out and get my own clients, that's essentially what I did 6 months later. And at the same time, I purchased my first investment property. So I was still in Atlanta, just coming out of grad school. So it was a gamble, but you know, it ended up working out in the long term.
Yeah, so let's talk about that. So purchasing your first investment property, how was that possible, right? Because a lot of people are gonna say, well, wait a minute, she just said she's working a free internship, she doesn't have a job, she's got, you know, thousands in student loans. How were you able to purchase and finance that? You know, what did that look like?
Well, it's crazy because that was just when I started my company. So I took off really fast. But you coming out of grad school, so you don't have any verifiable employment, right? I wasn't filing taxes at that point. I'm a new startup. You don't really have the credit that you needed. So it was a guy that I was dating at the time. It was like, what you want to do? I was like, I want to buy some houses.
I know that's right, girl.
And he was already like, you know, a businessman. So he had a trucking company. So he was like, look, I don't know anything about real estate, but I know that you're, you know, you've always been a hustler. So he essentially loaned me the down payment. So I bought an investment property. So I purchased it with hard money. So he essentially loaned me the down payment. I didn't have credit. So he was like, look, one of my boys, his credit is like A1. He was like, I'll introduce you and I'll ask him if he wants to be your guarantor. I'm like, go ahead. And that's literally how it happened. So I essentially was like the brains, one funded and one guaranteed. And I mean, it really off of like a handshake deal. I mean, I would never do that again. But it was really just off of word and trust. And it was like, all right, I know you're good for this, so I'll do it for you.
That's dope. Jay Morrison always talks about that. It's like, you don't have a credit problem, you have a strategy problem. And he also talks about just getting those partners. And so it's cool to see somebody who actually did it. I don't know if we've ever had anybody on the show that like, that's what they did. So that's dope. Was that a flip or did you live in that house or what did you do with that property?
So it was a flip. So it was like the sweetest time in Atlanta. Investing is like 2006. I mean, obviously it was a lot of fraud going on, but it was like anything went. So it was they got their money back within 30 days because I did the hard money. So we got the initial check and then like it was so much equity in it that we refied, pulled out more money. So it ended up being a good deal pre-market crash. And at the same time, I purchased my second property. It was a brand new property that I found an owner that was in Florida and they were trying to rent it out. It was in a brand new subdivision. And I guess like they couldn't find a tenant fast enough. And that's the time where, you know, all these real estate books were still at Barnes and Noble. So I literally used to sit at Barnes and Noble for like 3, 4, 5 hours at a time and just read the books for free. And so, you know, I would learn about all of these, you know, tricks that you could do back then that probably don't really work now. And so I learned about wraparound mortgages. So I found this seller that, you know, there was a gap between when they purchased the property and them not being able to find a tenant. And so I essentially called them up and was like, look, would you be willing to do a wraparound mortgage on this? They didn't know anything about it. So I just kind of schooled them on it. And they literally put me on title and I only put $500 down. So I'm 23, 24 with a 5-bedroom, 2-car garage, brand new house and a brand new subdivision. And so that was like the first two deals. So like, you know, you feel a little cocky by that point. And you learn, you know, because the market crashed the following year. So your cockiness catches up to you really quick. So that was like, you know, you had a quick high and then you come right back down, reality check.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And at the same time, like you say, you're also building up your marketing business. And so what did that look like as, you know, you don't have a 9-to-5 to fall back on, you know, you're taking these very risky moves with the investing in real estate, but then also building a business. How were you able to generate your leads and your clients for, you know, just being a new student out of grad school?
Well, you know, the beauty about being young is that you're naive too, but you don't really think about the risks. If I think about it now, I'm like, oh yeah, that was pretty risky. But at that point, I'm like, what do I have to lose? I already said that I'm not going to work, right? I already said that I need to create my own job. You know, I already knew that corporate was just not going to fit me. I realized very early in college that I was a bad employee. So I was like, I can't go with somebody, you know? So it's like, I don't have anything to lose. So I don't think there was ever a moment where I'm like, okay, this could be a really good thing or a really bad thing. It was just like, I saw opportunity and I went for it. So when I started my marketing agency, I went into the entertainment industry. So doing like marketing PR for record labels. And that's like right when Napster was hot and all of that. So it was sweet at that time as well. So business like started really, really fast. And remember, I did that internship 6 months prior. So that gave me a lot of really good access really fast. So you're young and you have a business on one end that's making really good money. And then a real estate business where, you know, you're seeing that you have properties. I mean, you don't really see failure at that point because you're like, okay, at 23, 24, who else could be doing this? I'm on a roll. So you don't really think about risk or failing.
What made you do both at the same time instead of just going all in on one?
Because I'm crazy. I've always been an entrepreneur. So even as a kid, I've always had entrepreneur-like ambitions. So I see something and I want it now. I don't think about like, okay, what's the priority? I want it. Just like I said, I was in the 8th grade and I was like, you know, I think I could skip the 12th grade and just head to college. And my counselors and my parents are like, there's no way. I took my SAT in the 8th grade. And by the 11th grade, I was like, all right, I'm off to college. So it's like, I don't really think that far ahead. I just think for that moment. And then whatever it is that, you know, I decided on for that moment, I just put everything in pursuing it. So I think that's a naive bet too, because not thinking too far ahead, you don't really think about failure or risk. And that could be dangerous as well, you know, but that's also the beauty of just kind of like going with the moment for right now.
Yeah, it is actually scientifically proven that there's a part of our brain that doesn't fully develop until we're like 26, 27 that allows us to think about the decision that we're making today and how it will affect us in the future. And that's why it's like, oh, you know, young, dumb teenagers or young, dumb, you know, early 20s, because a lot of folks make a lot of their mistakes not thinking ahead. But with you, it worked out in your favor. Because you were like,
no, because, you know, the market crashed the following year. So that's the part where you don't have wisdom to time the market. You don't understand economics. You know, I'm not looking at charts and seeing how, you know, the market and the economy is looking. I'm not like right now, I listen to economists, right? I was not thinking about that then. I'm just thinking, okay, it's just going to be sweet forever. You know, so when the market crashed, I mean, I'm like, shoot, I got a long ways to 30. Like, if anything, this would be wiped off my books really fast. That's literally how I thought, you know. So that was the beauty of being young at that point.
Yep. And I'm glad you mentioned that too, because actually that was going to be my follow-up question. So the crash comes and, you know, you have this property, this subdivision, you know, the property in the subdivision in Florida. You know, what was that like? And then had you acquired any other property at that time?
Yeah, I acquired one more right before the market crashed. So it was three properties down. The first property that I did with the guy that I was dating at that time, we had already taken money out because I had a lot of equity when I purchased it. So we had already taken money out. So when the market crashed, I was like, look, they could come get this house real quick. I was like, I've already gotten a couple of checks from one of the properties. You know, the other properties, I was like, you know, I got a, you know, little check from it. It was not the biggest because I didn't have enough time to really make that money. And then the house that I got on a wraparound, I lived in that. So when the market crashed, I was like, I need to downsize. So I just put a Section 8 tenant. I was like, look, I could go back to a one bedroom. I'm single with no kids. What am I doing in a five bedroom?
What did you do in that big of a house?
Empty. She was balling. Parties every night, turn it up.
When my friends would come to Atlanta, they would occupy the other rooms, but literally I only occupied the master and then my office. So you have three rooms that's not being used. And that's the stuff that you do at that age, because, you know, ego. You're like, I got a big house. My mom was like, why don't you put a roommate in each of those rooms? I'm like, I don't need no roommate. I can afford it. Then the market crashes. You're like, yeah, I should have had a roommate or a roommate. You know, and so
what was your payment on that house?
All in, it was probably like $1,500 all in. That's taxes, insurance, everything, you know. Right. So, yeah. So at that point, I'm literally, you know enough about credit to be like, you know, 7 years, right? So I'm like, you know, by the time that comes around, I'm going to just be 30, you know? So I still feel like that was young enough to rebound. So for me, I was like, look, I made the money.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So what did the rebound look like for you?
It was really focusing more on the marketing side at that point. So I got out of the entertainment industry. Napster crashed because record labels was like, what do we do about this digital, this MP3? Mm-hmm. Nobody could figure it out. I was like, look, at this point, let me just tap out. Record stores, I dealt a lot with DJs and record stores, college radio stations, all of that stuff essentially crashed. So it's like, that's all of my business. So, and nobody can figure out what do they do with this new digital format. So I was like, look, let me go on the corporate side. Let me, you know, focus on government. Plus dealing with the entertainment industry, being a woman, a young woman, was a headache anyway. So I was like, let me just leave that and just focus on corporate. So really, I rebuilt. I rebranded, renamed the company, and just rebuilt from the marketing side. And I just focused on that for a while. And so that was the humbling part, you know, because you have a fast rise and then it drops really fast. And then, like, you're seeing everything that you had just be like, look, let me downsize. You're like, okay. I learned failure really quick. You know, which is really good too. So it's good that I learned it then, because at that point, not that it created fear or I became more risk averse, but now I think more about the steps in between before I say, let me go ahead and do something. Mm-hmm. So it made me a bit more prudent in terms of how I make decisions and investments, et cetera. So it was, you know, humbling.
So before we're trying to ask the next question, I have a selfish question. So you jump out of college and you start your business. How are you managing your finances such that you don't like run out of money, but then you also have money coming in, if you know what I mean? So it's like when you become an entrepreneur, it's not like you have a paycheck coming in. So you can't just say, hey, I know in 2 weeks I'll get more money. So what does that look like financially for you? Like, how are you making that work?
Well, the music industry was very profitable for me. So I always had the income coming in. So I didn't really have the gaps. And two, like, I've never been a big spender. So even though I had the things, I never really was like, let me go shop and, you know, blow my cash. So I've never been a big spender. So I always, like, was very smart in terms of having money saved up. So I never had those issues.
Hey ladies, this is your co-host, Rashana Scott. And are you looking for a community of women real estate investors? If so, I want to take a quick second to share with you Infinity Membership. Sorry, fellas, but Infinity Membership is a women's only online community for newbie and experienced investors. Come let your hair down and join a non-judgment zone sisterhood where all of your questions about investing in real estate get answered. This is also an opportunity to learn from the best of the best. Other seasoned and successful women in the industry share their success tips often. Our live group sessions are twice a month, and we support each other daily within our private Facebook group. Our sessions range from driving for dollars, to working with contractors, to out-of-state investing, raising private capital, marketing your deals, and so much more. Does this sound like something that you've been looking for? Well, we would love to have you. For more information, visit us at bit.ly/infinity membership. Again, that's bit.ly/infinity membership.
Okay.
Yeah.
Nice.
I put myself on a budget.
There you go. So post-crash. So like you said, you were building the marketing side back up with going after corporate clients and government clients. How difficult was that? So you did the rebrand, and now you actually have to seek those contracts. Let's talk a little bit about that. And like you said, being a young woman in business, a young Black woman, were there advantages that you saw on the corporate and governmental side that you did not see in the music industry?
Yeah, there is definitely advantages. It's legit money. You know, it's checks, right? Versus in the music industry, they paying you cash, right? So that legitimizes a lot of things, for one. And then so you have to understand structure and processes and systems. Whereas in the music industry, you know, somebody might be like, look, I need this done. And there's no contracts. You know, maybe it's different now, but it was just like time, like, as things move on, that's when they do things. So you have to like kind of reprogram yourself, right? Government and corporate, they take 30 days to pay, right? Whereas in the music industry, they need a service done, they pay you today, or at best, maybe 7 days later. So things like that. It was difficult getting started because for one, you're young. I'm still under 25 at that point. No. So I'm like the little girl, pat on the head, like, what do you know? You know, you only been out of grad school for 2 years. You know, what do you know? And remember, I skipped the 12th grade, so I'm graduating grad school earlier than what I normally, so I was even younger. So they're looking at me like, you don't really know what you're talking about. You know, you can't possibly help us in that perspective. So that was difficult, you know, trying to make yourself credible in a space where people were like your senior, and then having to learn how they buy. So I can't go out and pitch you like I could in the music industry. You know, they have a different system for buying. So I would say it probably took like a good 3 to 5 years to really find a nice little sweet spot. And even then, like even now, you know, I'm going on, 14 years in business. I'm still learning because now I'm moving into the federal space. So I'm still learning. So even then, you still have to continuously learn the system.
Yeah. And what I love about that is like the art of the pivot, like you said, and I believe a lot of people are going through that with what's going on today. Right. And you've been able to navigate not, you know, one, but coming up on two, quote unquote, I hate to say that we're in an official recession, but, you know, a market crashes or whatever you want to call it. But like you said, at those different levels, it's all about pivoting and then seeking other opportunities in your business and other opportunities of where you can just go to the next level.
Right. Right. I mean, even now I'm pivoting into the federal segment because my clients were largely like corporate and then state and local government. And then there's a lot of competition in that space. And as I learned more about the federal space, most of the set asides for women owned businesses don't go to women businesses, you know, so not enough women businesses are competing for them. And then there are certain categories, even when you go into the IT space, cyber tech, there's probably very few women owned businesses. So I'm having to retool, you know, how do I now transition from being a marketing type company to being more of a well-rounded type company where I can take on a technology type contract, but still do communications related work? How do I kind of like show some type of synergy between them? So I go through like a reinvention, I would say every 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. Some of it not as drastic, but more so reinvention in terms of the look and feel of how I'm selling, you know, and positioning my services. And 2019 was kind of like that year of just relearning the business, to relearn how to sell. I've never been a business development person, because in the entertainment industry, there was no business development. You have, you know, contacts, you have a reputation, you can pick up a phone, somebody can give you business. But so I had to like restructure how I pursue business to be more proactive. And so now 2020 is a total focus on the federal sector, whereas 2019 was still kind of blended.
So it's interesting because, like you said, you finished school so early. What are you doing now to kind of still stay advancing your education and your knowledge base?
I'm done with school. But I read a lot, not necessarily books, but I'm always like searching online for information. And then that leads you to a rabbit hole. You know, I'm listening to experts. I'm always like looking at information. So that kind of keeps me, you know, grounded on what's new, what's evolving, and what new trends are.
And what did your first deal post-recession look like?
Well, that's the one. Well, if you say we just got into a recession, I closed March 13th, right? So that's the Detroit building. It's the 138-unit building. So I don't know if we were technically in a recession then, but that's my most recent one. And that was a distressed property that I purchased in Detroit.
So how did you find that deal and how did you acquire it?
Okay, so I had been investing in Miami, more single family than I did a single family. I purchased a historic property in Jacksonville 2 years ago. And that was a headache. That went from being a 90-day rehab to being 12 months. Had to sue a contractor, fired a couple of contractors, you know, cuss some people out. And at that point, I was like, I am forever done in anything that's not a certain number of units. I'm not dealing with small contractors anymore. I'm not dealing with small properties. If I got to have this much stress, I need to have scale in that. I personally thought at that point, I was like, where can I go? Because I know I can't get scale the way I want to get scale in Miami. And then Atlanta was starting to be a little too competitive. So I was like, where can I go that's going to give me scale and where I'm not going to like have to fight competition? So I was looking for like secondary markets that have some growth potential. And not that Detroit is the strongest secondary market, but just following it, I saw that there was a lot of efforts and initiatives around revitalization. I mean, obviously people get tempted by the price points in Detroit. So I was like, let me go ahead and spend some time on the ground. So I started in Detroit last summer. And then just had a developer friend essentially kind of take me by the hand and was like, look, this is what you need to figure out in Detroit. These are the areas. These are the people that you need to know. So that building was one of the first buildings that I saw on my first visit to Detroit. And I spent all summer pretty much going back and forth, just learning the market. But at that time, the developers that kind of became a mentor to me was like, that building's too big for you. You might not want to deal with that on your first go around here. You know, do something a bit more manageable. There was a 25 unit that I was also interested in. For some reason, I kept coming back to that 138. I'm like, man, I know it's too big, but I think I could. And so the price just kept coming down. So essentially, I kept my eye on that one, but was kind of like positioning myself to pursue the smaller one. And then I was like, if I'm going to do a deal in a city like this that already has its challenges, let me do something that's going to be big and that's going to be significant to the type of impact it could create. So I started to put all my eggs in that one basket. I actually ended up buying it under auction. That was not the original intent. I was, you know, going back and forth with the seller to purchase it, but they got to a point to where they were like, look, we're going to put this under auction. Do you want to move on this now? And I was like, look, I still want to put all the pieces together because this is still risky. I don't want to just jump into it and figure out the capital later in terms of how the stack is going to work out. So when they ended up putting it under auction, I was like, okay, well, it's now or never.
So what was the purchase price at the auction?
$340,000, yeah.
Wow.
$340,000, wow. Yeah. So it was probably close to $1 million just before I saw it. And then when I actually started pursuing it, it came down to $750.
Wow.
And it just kept coming down.
So you
mentioned- How long was that out at auction?
Probably a 30-day auction. The actual bidding time frame was only 2 days. Mm-hmm. But it was listed on the auction for 30 days.
So can you talk to us about the capital stack and how you're going to finance the project?
So this is a new learning curve. So when you ask me, how do I continue to educate myself? So, you know, obviously I've always started in private money. And if anything, I'll raise equity from investors or private equity firms. So that's how I initially was pursuing this property. I was pitching every private equity firm. I go to New York a lot. So I would go to New York and meet with like PE guys and just pitch them on this. But when you have 8 months on to kind of think through a deal, it kind of gives you a lot more ideas. You're talking to people. So the more I talk about it, the more it kind of evolves. I never thought it would be an assisted living facility. I was like, it's either going to be another multifamily or maybe just kind of keep the same intended use as a senior housing. But the more and more I started talking to other people, reading and learning about how the senior industry is just shifting and how that's going to be like a huge demographic shift, I was like, okay, this might not be bad. So I initially was pitching it for private equity. I got a lawyer in Detroit, and just him just connecting me to different people within the city and other entities. I'm like, okay, this might work as assisted living, but I'm still thinking debt, right? And maybe I'll pursue some soft loans through a CDFI, Community Development Financing Institution. And it's literally, I came into Detroit one week to, you know, discuss CDFI financing. And they were like, no, we can do LIHTC. You know, you want to talk about that? I was like, I remember vividly, I leaned over to my attorney. I was like, you know, you could jump in any moment because I don't know LIHTC, you know, but I was like, look, you know, help me out. You could jump in any moment in this conversation. And they were like, no, it's either going to be a LIHTC deal or we're not going to be able to do it. And that literally changed everything. So I'm like, okay, I know construction financing and just regular financing. I have no idea how this public financing stuff works. Mm-hmm. So now I'm having to like teach myself how that works. And now that I'm saying that it's going to be an assisted living facility, I got to learn Medicaid. Now, luckily I had what solidified it for me. I came across an operating partner that a colleague connected me to. And they were like, look, they created the first public senior housing project in the entire country 23 years ago. You might want to talk to them. So I'm literally just, you know, still, I hadn't purchased the building at that time, you know, but in my mind, I got the building already. So I asked my colleague to set up a dinner. So I'm at dinner with this now partner and I'm like, look, if I purchase this building, can you do it with me? They were like, yeah, we're not going to come in under equity, but we can do the operational part. I was like, that's all I need you for. You right. know, I don't know senior housing. I don't want to have to learn senior housing. But if I have someone that specializes in that space, then I'll feel confident. So now I'm developing an assisted living just from that one encounter. So, you know, the conversation shifted from construction financing to LIHTC. Now I'm having to redo my pro forma because my pro forma was for, you know, traditional financing, not LIHTC. So now I got to teach myself, how do you do a LIHTC pro forma?
But doesn't that benefit you, though, because you're going to get those tax credits?
Yeah. But when you don't know those other opportunities. I'm learning about soft loans. You know, I'm now pursuing not just LIHTC, but home funds from the state. And then there's like other funds that come from like CDBG. You know, if you don't know, I mean, there's so much money out there. If you don't know, you're just going to go ahead and stick with the expensive finance.
Right. And what you think, yeah, the only thing that you do know. Can you explain for those who may not know what LIHTC financing is and how that differs from, like you said, the traditional financing route that you were intending on going?
Right. So LIHTC is low income housing tax credits. So the federal government allocates each state a certain amount in these tax credits that the states now allocate to different syndicators, essentially people who can kind of act as a third party intermediary. So essentially the tax credits benefit not me as a developer, but the end buyer as the investor. So like Rashana, you're the investor, right? You are super wealthy. You need to reduce your tax liability. So you look to purchase tax credits that will help you reduce your tax liability. So the state does a 4% or a 9%. 9% obviously gives you more money, but it's super competitive, whereas 4% is on a rolling basis. So essentially 4% of your total construction cost that's eligible can be allocated to you, and they do that over a 10-year period. So let's say 4% of $10 million in construction, that's times 10. So that can be allocated to you. So you as the investor will buy the credits, right? And now you have a very tiny stake in my development project, but the benefit to you is that you've minimized your tax liability, and now I have upfront equity for my project. So let's say that 4% came up to $4 million and the construction was $10 million. That just reduced my loan need to $6 million. So I essentially just got $4 million in equity that now I only need $6 million in a loan. So that's definitely reducing the debt service. But the stipulation is that the project has to be affordable at 60% or below of AMI, the average moderate income for average medium income for that area. So that's the stipulation. It doesn't have to be 100% affordable, but the more affordable units you have, the more in credits you can allocate.
I think that's dope. I think that it's cool because you ran into that learning experience by running into the opportunity. And so instead of trying to figure it all out before you got in there, you just hopped in there and you figured it out while you're in there. So that's dope.
I literally spent 3 weeks, because when I had to restructure the pro forma to fit LIHTC, not just fit the LIHTC pro forma standards, but now I'm having, this is what I learned. When you're doing an assisted living facility, because you have services blended with housing, right? The underwriting part looks a little crazy because you're charging, say, $5,000 a month. But what kind of underwriter is going to look at it and be like, this unit is worth $5,000 a month? But really, it's loaded because the services side takes up the chunk. So services might be $4,000 and housing might be $1,000. So from an underwriting perspective, you know, you have to make it underwritable. So you have to split the pro forma to be housing only, services only, so that they can see that the property can stand on its own just from the housing financials. So that way, before services kicks in, they can say that this can meet debt service coverage. And then you have the blended pro forma. So I literally spent 3 weeks, because now I'm having to break down everything, cost, labor cost, you know, how Medicaid bills for meals, because you're doing 3 meals a day plus snack, transportation, you know, other activities of daily living. So I'm literally spending 3 weeks of just reading everything on Medicaid and reimbursements and tenant vouchers, you know, for Section 8 and how all of that works and what the numbers come out to. So that way I can redo my pro forma to make it fit LIHTC. So
the thing is, I think you walked into a home run. This sounds like an amazing deal. You're getting tax credit financing. You also have the ability to do something that's unconventional. So it's not just regular low income housing or even just regular apartment housing. You're literally able to bill 5 times what the normal person can charge for rent. So it's like you have wins stacked upon wins just because you took that risk. So that's super dope.
And not just that, but because of the way my operating partner created this model, I'm using housing vouchers and Medicaid waivers to pay for the services. And that's how it's affordable for the resident.
Right.
Because assisted living is expensive. It's from $5,000 to $8,000 a month. So generally, you got to be, you know, affluent to be able to pay for assisted living.
That's dope. Mm-hmm. Do it for the culture.
Yeah, that's genius. Where is there, I know you said they created like the first model for it. So is your partner, they're nationwide now? They have several locations?
Yeah. So the first model was created in Miami, actually, with the Miami-Dade Housing Commission. So now they manage senior facilities for other housing commissions. So city and state housing commissions, they essentially put these structures together.
Todd Consulting presents the Vending Machine Business Webinar. You can only have one job, but you can have as many vending machines as you want. This is your chance to see how we do business and how you can start your very own vending machine business. Avoid the mistakes we made and start winning. You'll be shown how we find, negotiate, buy, and manage our vending machine business, generating thousands per month, and how it has unlimited scale. To find out more details, hit us up on the link in the bio, on Instagram at PartnerWithMillie, or on Instagram at Todd.Capital, or just head over to Gumroad.com/Todd Capital.
Hi, how are you? I am Andre C. Hatchett, 15-year mobile notary pioneer and veteran. We have created the Notary Business School, which will show you how to start a successful, long-term, needed business as a mobile notary public. Well, with 15 years of experience and with different downturns in the economy, we have labeled this business as being recession-proof, meaning that you can run this business in any climate, any city, any state in America. On average, our students make between $60 and $250 per appointment, which usually takes under an hour. I'll say that again. On average, our students usually make between $60 and $250 per appointment as a mobile notary public. If you would like to enroll and save a few dollars, go to the website, millienotarypromo.com. That is millienotarypromo.com. Look forward to seeing you in class. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
And I love the way you were able to, like Charles said, just leverage your network essentially to get it done. You jumped out the window and you were building your parachute on the way down. I want to go back though, before even, you know, the latest deal. So the timing, I would say, I guess within, let's say the last 10 years, right? Like the last market crash up until now. So the majority of your projects were what, like single family flips in Florida, or what did that look like?
Yeah, so I took a break. So after the crash, I took probably like a 4 or 5 year break. That's when I just was just focused on the marketing side. You know, I was like, look, I need to like rebound or whatever, because you lose money with the crash. So I wasn't really thinking about real estate. And so how I got back in a few years ago, myself and a couple of friends, we decided to start a Black investment fund in Miami. Because, you know, Miami is Miami. So you have foreigners buying up Miami, buying up everything in the hood, buying it up on the beach, downtown, everything. So we're like, okay, why not create critical mass in the hood, in the Black areas, by buying up real estate, rehabbing them, and then selling it back to people within the community. So we put this fund together because we were all individually doing our own investments, but it was more so for social impact and to create like a proof of concept that we can do stuff like this collectively. So, and that was the whole point, like how do we influence other people to do the same thing? So we initially did it like with not the bigger picture in mind, but like let's do a proof of concept, you know, do a couple of deals, put a couple people in these homes. And then Miami, they offer, depending on your income, you can get up to $80,000 in down payment assistance.
So did you say 80? Like 80?
Yeah. So it's a combination. Wow. So it's like probably you can combine it from like 4 or 5 different entities, mm-hmm. and it totals up to $80,000. So essentially you can get you a $200,000 house, you know, for $120,000. So I had pretty much I was partnering with the housing entities that offer these grants. I was like, look, we got houses, you got buyers. So it made it easy as well. And so from that, NPR had caught on and did a story on it. And then that's when I was, okay, now's my time to get back and do it on my own, because I wanted to scale what we were doing much bigger and much faster. Mm-hmm. When you're investing with other people, sometimes everybody's speed is different. Yeah. So that's when I was like, okay, it's time for me to take off like how I initially intended to. Mm-hmm.
And so did you hold any properties, or it was all flips?
Well, with that group, those were flips in the sense of selling it back to people in the community. So we were very intentional. We wanted to sell it back to Black people, preferably. And sell it back to people from that community who were already comfortable being in that area. But I still hold, like I have my own personal investments that I still hold. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like in Jacksonville, historic, I converted it into a bed and breakfast. So I still have that. So I still like to hold some stuff.
Mm-hmm. And did you partner with someone to run the bread and breakfast also? Was that another partnership, or you pretty much run it?
Yeah, that was my own. So I made that into a smart house. So it's all automated.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How do you automate a bed and breakfast?
Look, I got all the apps from my AC to my doors to my lights to all the doors, bedroom doors. Exterior doors are all ran through my apps. So I literally just allow people to just, you know, you book and I can just automate everything. And if you need the dinner or the breakfast, I can just, I have the caterers and the chefs that I can just organize that stuff for.
And then you just send the cleaning lady in there every so often, right?
Every time they check out, the cleaning lady goes in.
That's cool.
That is. That's really cool. And so did you, was that on like Airbnb also, or you, this was kind of this was before Airbnb?
Well, it's on everything. It's on Expedia, Airbnb, hotels.com, booking.com, HomeAway, everything where you can book a hotel, it's on there.
Nice, nice. Cool. So I guess fast forwarding, then bringing us up to present day. So with the big project that you have in Detroit, so what's the timeline that you guys have on that?
So that's the thing about public money, right? It's slow money. It's slow money. So I had to have patient money to purchase that because I purchased that out of pocket. So you got to have patient money because LIHTC financing can be 6 to 9 months. And then if you do the 9% round, that's competitive. So I have to wait all the next spring for the next round just to do the 9% one. But I'm doing 4% for now, but I still want to see if I can, you know, be competitive for the 9%. And then I'm doing like, I'm pursuing home funds and some gap financing from the city and the state. That stuff takes a long time. So it's going to end up being a complicated stack, but the benefit is that it's going to be cheap money, a lot of equity, and then some soft loans. Whereas with the soft loans, you don't start paying it back until there's cash flow.
Wow.
It's an 18-month construction project, another 3 months for licensing and all that. So stabilization can be anywhere from the 21st to the 36th month, right? So if you have a soft loan, it kind of follows your cash flow. So I essentially could almost have that debt kind of be at zero until when I can say our cash flows are pretty strong.
Wow. So what do you do in the meantime while you're waiting for everything to line up?
I'm looking for another deal. I had a goal this year of having 500 units. That was before COVID, so that kind of slowed things down. So I've been trying to time it because I don't want to be insensitive and calling up, you know, owners and say, hey, are you open to selling your building? So I'm trying to time it to see when people's confidence are going to be back. But I still want to pursue my goal. At this point, it's May, so it's a short time frame to get to the remaining, you know, what, 350 units or so. But if I just find a building with 250 units or 350 units, you know, I've already hit that number. Yep. So, but I definitely don't want it to be one of these deals where I have to do the rehabilitation. I want it to be a stabilized value add deal.
Yeah.
So are you still looking at Detroit or are you exploring other markets?
Other markets. So Atlanta is like my other base. So between Atlanta and parts in Florida, like Jacksonville, I want to tap into Orlando and Tampa. I haven't yet, but I know those are like the hottest markets right now. And I've looked in a couple of markets in North Carolina. So, but I'm open to go anywhere there's a strong job market.
Do you work with any like mentees or do you do any coaching?
Mentees? No, I don't have any mentees. I have mentors, but I have like friends that just hit me up. And they ask me questions. So, you know, I give people, you know, advice like that. I'm not an expert, so I don't have classes, but I share. So I don't have a problem, like, you know, answering people's questions and sharing.
Yeah, that's cool. All right. So we're going to wrap it up. It's been a good amount of time. You definitely dropped a lot of game and a lot of value. So we do have a few questions that we ask towards the end. So I'm going to start those. Who is somebody that you look up to and why?
I have a lot of personal mentors that I look up to. And they have been people that have believed in me even before I actually got it, but they saw something in me. One of my mentors, he's a real estate guy in Miami. And this is when, you know, the crash happened. I'm focusing on marketing, but I know eventually I'll get back into real estate. I was like, hey, I want you to be my mentor. So he was like, all right, if you're willing to come into my office 3 times a week and just sit here, fine. I was like, all right. So, I mean, it would be days where I'm sitting there listening to him run his mouth. And I'm like, I'm not getting anything from it. But what I eventually did get is a good relationship to where I can hit him up with any questions, you know, and he's not going to be like, I'm too busy. And then I have my mentor that led me to Detroit. He's in Florida. And I was like, hey, I think I want to go into Detroit. He's from Detroit. He was like, let me put you with my attorney. He's the man in Detroit. So his attorney ended up, you know, I asked his attorney, I need a co-developer. Who do you think can co-develop this with me? So he started throwing out names. I'm like, and he threw out one name. I'm like, So he led me to my co-developer and essentially, you know, was leading me to other people. When I went into the meeting about the initial financing, he was there with me. So it was people like that to where they like, look, what you say you want to do sounds a little crazy, but you have so much belief in what you're saying that I'll ride with you on it. So those are the people that I would kind of credit.
That's cool. What's your favorite business or real estate book?
I don't have one because I don't have time to read, which is bad. I had a goal this year of reading 2 books a month, and I have failed miserably. So, I mean, I've read the typical books that everyone likes to say. There was a business book that I read some years ago called The Slight Edge that still kind of sticks out to me, and it's about growing 1% daily. So every day kind of having a growth mindset to where you're growing, you're getting a slight edge, 1% daily. So it doesn't have to be like a big growth spurt that you go through. Just thinking about the small wins in between.
Yeah, definitely. I like that. What would you say sets apart successful investors from those who fail, give up, or never get started?
Well, I would not say that just because you fail, you're not successful. I failed. No. I think that's just part of the story. You have to fail. So if you have not failed, I'm like, you need to fail, right? Because you need to learn the hard way. So no one's going to really teach you everything you need to know. You have to learn it on your own. So you got to fail. But I think consistency, right? And then perseverance. So one of the things that have kept me in, and I've gone through a lot of the first recession, you know, having to rebuild a business, having to rebuild myself, my finances, et cetera, is just having a relentless confidence that it doesn't matter what the current looks like, that you know, like what the bigger picture is. So even at my lowest point, I was never like, oh gosh, it's over for me. I'm like, well, I'm gonna have to figure out how to come up from here. So I think being relentless on your ambition and on your goal to succeed.
Nice. What does wealth mean to you?
You know, I just created a living trust. So, and thinking about your future and how you want to distribute your stuff in the future. And I'm still young, I'm under 40. So to have those kind of thoughts, like how do I want things to be distributed? Knowing that I don't have everything that I'm going to have just yet, but just kind of believing in what your future is going to look like. To me, that sounds like wealth. And then my advisors that's been working with me, they have this idea of creating a 200-year plan, right? That things live beyond you 200 years from there. So how do you make that? How do you create that dynasty now? So that way you have a 200-year plan. And so that makes me feel like, you know, not that I'm wealthy, but that at some point, I would have accomplished that. So it's really just being able to look into your future and say, look, everybody's good. I've already accounted for how my parents and siblings and, you know, kids and all of that's going to be taken care of and the generation after them. And even then, I have the living trust created, but I just met up with my trust attorney again today because, like, I'm learning more in the process. And I'm like, no, I don't want to just give away my stuff and have them squander it off. So now we're talking through how do I have it be reinvested? So now my stipulation is that you don't just get things in the trust. That has to be reinvested for real estate. So there's no money that's being handed out to you. So that kind of makes me feel good about the future that I want to create.
That's good. That's good.
So where can people find out more about what you have going on? Where can they follow you? And where can they just interact with you online?
Instagram, so at Invest with Fab, and then I'm on LinkedIn, Fabiola Florinville, and then my company, Icon Heritage Partners, so you can find that online, iconheritagepartners.com.
Cool. Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.
You said what? To your tribe of, you're going to recruit her to your tribe of women investors?
Oh, yeah. She's already recruited.
You put
my dog in. This was definitely a great interview. Thank you so much for sharing all of the gems. I am excited to see the updates on the senior living facility and just everything that you have going on. I know it won't be anytime soon within the next couple of months, but these were a lot of good gems. I mean, you know, like you say, even just starting out, like, you shared so many great principles as far as just basics of entrepreneurship, right? Like jumping out the window, figuring it out, getting started, starting a company from scratch with, you know, not having a ton of like corporate experience and things like that. And like you said, just going for it. So definitely commend you for that. And thank you so much for hopping on and sharing your story with our listeners.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Episode 145, Charles Oglesby with Rashana Scott, signing off.
This episode of the Todd Capital Millionaire Podcast is sponsored by Hood Estates. Hood Estates is offering a Hood Estates Elite Real Estate Investing Program, as well as a Hood Estates Trekking Program. All the details can be found in the show notes. You can also find them on Instagram at Hood Estates.
Money to pay off debt and increase your income? I'm Terry Igioma from Invest with Terry, and I teach an online course on how to invest in the stock market for daily or weekly returns. My 7-step strategy saves you time and erases the guesswork from trading. With these 7 steps, I've earned over $16,000 in a day without having a large account. Start big or small. These proven steps will increase your profits and decrease your losses. To learn more, visit itradeandtravel.com.